So we're in the middle of some ongoing explorations that have to do with prayer. And I want to stay in that space, but I also want to mark the fact that in the wider world of Christendom, we're at the beginning of the season of Lent, which, as I mentioned in the blurb, kicks into gear on Ash Wednesday, which was this past Wednesday. If you were here last week, you might recall that I read from Julie Cameron's book, Prayers from a Non-Believer, and she starts the first prayer in the book this way: I do not have an easy relationship to you, God. I am confused by your press. And she goes on to talk about how confusing it is to read different takes on God from what she calls quarrelsome experts. And as someone whose work often takes them into the terrain occupied by said quarrelsome experts, I can relate to that. And something like the season of Lent, I think, is no exception to those quarrels and confusion. So by way of sort of setting this up, and it's going to end up being a mashup, but by way of sort of setting this up, I want to take a few moments to consider some of the press that Lent has gotten. I think it's fair to say that the most common cultural understanding of what Lent is about has something to do with self-punishment. And we might not call it that. We might frame it in terms of repentance or something like that. But what gets the press tends to be the question, what am I or what are you giving up for Lent? And then the tropes kick in, right, in response to the question. So typically the tropes are concentrated around whatever's on our list of guilty pleasures, usually things that have something to do with our bodies, our appetites, or our habits. So the classics, the archetypes almost are things like coffee, chocolate, ice cream, alcohol, Netflix, Facebook. Do people still use Facebook? Lying, sex, virtual or actual, whatever. And then if we follow any sort of Lenten practice at all, we grudgingly give something, or if we're very spiritual, several somethings up. But oh, the suffering of going without coffee. There's the headaches, there's the grouchiness, there's the constant battle to not be snarky about little things. I'm making all of this up because I don't drink coffee. This is just based on observation. So, not bad? Okay, good, all right, good. Thank you for affirming that. He's not in the room to defend himself, so we'll come back to that. When I think about Lent that way, the thought that comes to mind is, would someone please remind me while we're putting ourselves through this? Because it's Lent is not a good enough answer. Let it be Lent. I'm pretty sure Lent's going to get along just fine without me depriving myself of something I enjoy just because it's Lent. So what's running in the background that gives this enough collective oomph that as a culture we're still thinking of it primarily in terms of giving something up? Well, traditionally, Lent is this period of fasting, moderation, and self-denial. Starts on Ash Wednesday, goes till Easter Sunday. And this all got decided, pay attention, when something is discernibly decided by humans, it's a human decision. And that makes it fair game for full scrutiny. So this all got decided somewhere in the 4th century. So even though that time frame that I just described, Ash Wednesday to Easter Sunday, even though that adds up to 46 days, Lent is actually 40 days in length because the Sundays are days off or feast days. And so if you gave up coffee, you can like pound it on Sunday, all right? And if you give up too many things and you try to pack them all into Sunday, like that can kill you. But you'll probably die satiated. So, you got to weigh these things. Given the time frame in which this practice got started, its roots in the Christian tradition are within what we might now think of as Catholicism, which simply means that it started well before there was anything like a Protestant, like a long time before there was anything like a Protestant. And the historic emphasis has been on prayer and fasting, especially with a focus on confessing our wrongdoings and asking God for forgiveness. So there's just a little bit of background. And as these sorts of history go, the idea that we can convince God of our sincerity by giving something up, by making a sacrifice, is still one that seems to hold quite a lot of currency. So we're giving up coffee so God won't blast us for whatever else is on the I shouldn't have done that list. And yes, I do understand that that is a rhetorically motivated oversimplification. I want to make something visible that we might not otherwise bother to stop and think about regarding Lent and the practice of giving things up for Lent, because I want to invite us to consider this whole season from a different perspective. I do not wish to undermine the value of fasting, moderation, or self-denial. Those are all disciplines that can make substantial contributions to our well-being, body, mind, and spirit. I do wish to invite us to consider the possibility that there are other ways to approach Lent, and particularly prayer during Lent, so there's that intersection that I was talking about, ways that can expand our imagination of what this season might be in our own spiritual lives and explorations. So what I want to do is just see what happens if we have a bit of a mashup of those ideas of prayer and fasting, together with Lent in general, what it's about, and the space we've been in, which is prayer for I don't know what I believers. Okay? So let's just see what happens. Lent happens at a time of the year when in this hemisphere the days are getting longer. That's where Lent gets its name. Lenten is just a different way to say lengthened, like you had a bad cold. Lenten. It's Lenten. That's actually where the word comes from. That's the history of it. Days are getting longer. It's Lent. Lenten days. So there you go. Now you can remember that. Right? Yeah. It was sort of like super spiritual, right? No, it's actually just like the days are getting longer. Yeah. Yeah, so there you go. Because you have your spring cold. Exactly. So there you go. There's little known history of, but actually the fact. That is the roots of the word. And when it comes to marking this time of the year, Lent actually, as a practice, stands on the shoulders of much older celebrations, some of which still enjoy lively practice. This is intriguing to me because, remember, Lent kicked in the 4th century. It's pretty old. But it's standing on the shoulders of things that are much older. For instance, on this continent, Aboriginal spirituality, which is deeply rooted in connection to the land and the rhythms of the land, marks the turning of each season in very deliberate ceremonial ways. And if you want to, you could, in March, travel out to the San Di Salto Spiritual Center and take part in a ceremony that attends to the turning of winter into spring, something that I'm actually planning to do. I've got a couple of schedule pieces I have to kind of move around a little bit, and if you want to join me, let me know if you're interested. Adrian Jacobs, who is the keeper of the circle at San Di Salto, will be our guest here next week, something I'm really excited about, and sort of the way I've become aware of some of these things. Adrian's been instrumental in my own growing awareness about that. The spirituality that is running in the background of that ceremony, that First Nations ritual marking the turning of the seasons, the spirituality that's running in the background of that ceremony is way, way, way older than the history of Lent. As are many of the Celtic ceremonies that provided the basic rhythms that informed the earliest shapes of European Christianity. Celtic spirituality also being very connected to the earth and also to the sacred feminine. More on that in the months to come. We'll get there. So in many ways, if you kind of take those bits of history about Lent and pre-Lent, it's not very hard to see that the roots of Lent are in the literal earth. They are in the thaws that hint at spring and at new life. And it's really not that hard to see where that would end up linked to a religious idea like resurrection. Again, more on that another time. We're headed for Easter. We will talk about resurrection. For now, let's just step away from the thought that we need to pray or fast to placate an angry deity and ask why else we might do such things, especially at this time of year. Just kind of reframe the question a little bit. I think it might help to ask what those two practices that are kind of at the heart of Christian Lenten disciplines, the practices of prayer and fasting, to ask what those have in common. And we could probably come up with quite a list of things that prayer and fasting have in common, but for this morning, I want to suggest that one of the most potent commonalities is that both prayer and fasting are ways of stopping what we're doing and considering them from a different vantage point. And let's think about them both, just for now, as ways of either putting something down, stopping doing it, or picking something up, starting doing something new or different. One of the things that neuroscience and the other behavioral sciences have made clear in the past decades is that changing how we do something familiar causes our brains to function differently. And it seems to, that practice of taking something familiar and altering our approach to it, it just seems to knock loose more creativity, more flexibility, more insight, and a deeper affective or felt experience. And this is one of the reasons why folks that, for instance, instruct young visual art makers often get them to draw images upside down, or with their non-dominant hand, or even with their eyes closed. All of the art, by the way, all of those wonderful musician and instrument figures that are on the end of the West End Cultural Center, all produced that way. Yeah, it's pretty fascinating. Anyways, so stuff just goes off when we do that. When we do things like that with something we thought we knew, our brains seem to take it up a notch. That different parts of our brain, if they're being scanned, light up with activity. Things that are usually just kind of sitting there, parked, come to life. And the resultant outputs are also enlivened. Now, if our spirituality matters to us, if we think it's important in our lives, why wouldn't we want it to be an enlivened, expanding, growing thing? Wouldn't we want to bring our best creativity, our best imagination, our most effective practices to something that matters as much as making contact with God? So, how might prayer be a way of putting something down or picking something up? Just hold that thought for a moment, and let's see what happens if we connect that to the idea of fasting. Fasting is something we're familiar with in general terms. Fasting is not a religious idea per se. It's just a well-known technique when it comes to several different models of nutritional management, health, well-being, athletic training, and so on. It just means going without, typically in reference to food, but also to any number of other things. So in the context of what we've been considering from the history of Lent, we might imagine that to mean fasting from Netflix or chocolate or from whatever. It's a way of stopping something familiar so we get knocked out of the rut of that habit. In spiritual practices, it's a way of getting jarred loose from the ways in which our religious practices and understandings, so not just habits, but also not just physically expressed habits, but also habits of thought and belief, they can easily become rote, and they can cease to be vibrant and alive and meaningful, even if they really did start that way. So how might we apply that to something like prayer? Well, if we want to imagine a way that prayer might be connected to fasting as a way of putting down something for Lent, here's an idea. Try not praying for Lent. But just for the 40 days of Lent, just put it down. You can go nuts on Sunday. You can pray all day. Gorge on prayer. But for 40 days, just don't do it. This really only applies if you do something that you call praying, so you have something to put down, right? What about the other side of the idea? What about taking something on? Well, you could try praying in a way that you've never tried before, sort of metaphorically non-dominant hand praying. Because this is all connected to our bodies, this might be as simple as only praying in places where you otherwise wouldn't. So, if you usually pray in your room, try only praying at the mall. If you usually pray silently, try praying only out loud, maybe not at the mall. Yeah, nobody's gonna think twice about it. That's an excellent point. Huh. Okay, yeah, and in your car, they just think you're singing along. If you usually call God Father, just try Mother, like for 40 days. And if you fail, feel guilty as hell and confess, and then just try again. Because then that'll be very Lenten sort of feeling. And if you really want to have an enlivening experience, try praying without anthropomorphizing or gendering God at all. If you're used to imagining a superhuman when you pray, which lots of us are, and you try to do without that, it's fascinating. Because all of a sudden, the idea that God is just a supersized human is like getting assailed in your imagination. It's fascinating. Here's an idea that might encompass both putting something down and picking something up. This might benefit from a little bit of background. A year before Japan's 2011 earthquake and tsunami, which killed approximately 20,000 people, there was a 70-year-old man in Japan named Atiru Sasaki, and his cousin had recently died, and he was struggling to come to terms with that loss. And he wanted a place where he could privately air his grief, and he had a bit of a rural property, so he put an old-fashioned phone booth. Remember those? He put an old-fashioned phone booth on his property, and he put in a shelf, and he put in this black rotary dial phone. The phone has no dial tone, no electricity. It is connected to nowhere. And for Sasaki, the idea was that he wanted to tell his cousin how much he missed him and how much he loved him. And he wanted his message to be carried by the wind. And so he called this whole thing that he had made Kaze no Denwa, which is phone of the wind. And then the tsunami happened, and 20,000 people died. And the word got out about this phone booth and this phone of the wind. And making a pilgrimage to this place turned into a national phenomenon. And in the subsequent 3 years after the tsunami, more than 10,000 people visited that phone booth. And it got to be such a noteworthy thing that in 2016, a Japanese public broadcaster made a documentary film that featured the phone booth, and it included some of the conversations that visitors had inside it. And in one scene in that dock, there's a man, he's wearing a long jacket, he walks through the snow and into the booth, and he picks up the receiver, and in the dock we can hear what he's saying. And he says, if you can hear me, oh, I will do this, but it might take a moment. If you can hear me, please listen. Sometimes I don't know what I'm living for. Let me hear your voice saying daddy again. And he takes this long pause, and he just sobs, and he hangs up, and he removes his glasses, and he covers his eyes, and he whispers, I'm so sorry. I couldn't save you. And then when he leaves the phone booth, he talks to the journalist that's outside the booth, and he says, if I forget, who would remember them? In another scene in that doc, a man dials a number. He says, hello, love, where are you? I hope you haven't caught a cold. Hurry home to me. We're all waiting, okay? Make sure you eat well. I miss you. Listen, the word wind is the word that the New Testament translates as Spirit. A trek to Japan to shake up how we pray might be out of reach, but let me make a more pragmatic, even sort of prosaic suggestion. In my imagination, this is an idea that connects the dots of putting something down, which is fasting, taking something up, and reconsidering what we might imagine prayer to be. This is an invitation, not a directive, of course. Go to a place that is relatively unfamiliar to you. It doesn't need to be exotic or hard to reach, just not familiar. Take out your phone and turn it off. Don't put it to sleep. Power it down. Disconnect it from the network so it is connected to nothing, to the wind. And then hold it in your non-dominant hand and put it to your ear and pray. Nobody needs to know that you did this. This is not anybody else's business. When people asked Jesus how to pray, he said, go into the closet and pray. That might literally be worth a shot. He also said that when we act out our spirituality, we should do it in ways that mean that our left hand doesn't know what our right hand is doing. I think he said more than he knew in neuroscientific terms. To put it in other words, wherever and however you pray, don't bother to do it for anyone but you. And don't bother to do it in a way that makes it anyone else's affair. And do it in ways that shake up your normal. And if it makes you cry, when you're done, wash your face and carry on. Jesus made that suggestion originally. Did you know that? I might be paraphrasing a little, but you can look it up if you want. This is all in the Gospel of Matthew, 6th chapter, where Jesus is teaching about prayer and fasting. As Matthew tells the story, Jesus says this: when you fast, do not look somber as the hypocrites do, for they disfigure their faces to show others they are fasting. Truly I tell you, they have received their reward in full. But when you fast, do your hair and wash your face so that it will not be obvious to others that you are fasting. But only, and Matthew's language is unmitigatingly gendered here, but he's speaking of God. It will not be obvious to others that you are fasting, but only to your Father who is unseen, and your Father who sees what is done in secret will reward you. So go ahead, pray to the wind, and then wash your face just using your non-dominant hand. You can always pray out loud in community time and, you know, use both hands to wash up on Sunday. Peace.